This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been the target of Western hostility since its establishment in 1979. Machinations to pull off regime change, to incite public disorder, to undermine the nation's prosperity and productivity through sanctions and other repressive economic measures, and to outright threaten the country with military confrontation are just small lists of challenges faced by the steadfast nation of 80 million plus people. Now, Tehran's answer to all these provocative plots has always been to persevere diplomatically, from joining budding or established international bodies to forging strong ties with non-Western entities by looking to the east, to Africa, to South America, and to its own backyard. Iran continues to offset any threats posed to its stability through multi-layered diplomatic maneuvering. And it's this very diplomatic diplomacy that we'll be discussing in today's Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Mr. Nick Napier, activist and commentator, joining us from Glasgow. And Mr. Saeed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us out of London.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Let's see who to start with. I guess, Mr. Mick Napier, we'll start with you in Glasgow. Your thoughts on where Iran would be today if it answered back the threats and the moves designed to instigate and provoke the country over the last 4 decades plus with a harsher response and relied less on diplomatic efforts and channels?
Well, I think it was an American president, Teddy Roosevelt, who said, "Speak softly and carry a big stick." And what he meant was diplomacy is important. You can't go around simply insulting and humiliating. You have to find a way to deal with other states. But if that fails, then America was always ready to use a big stick. And by a big stick, they meant naked force, military force, to coerce opponents into submission. And that has been the consistent history of the USA. for at least 100 and odd years. But what's changed is that they no longer speak softly. I mean, Trump is not, doesn't speak softly at all. He only knows the big stick. But that tells you the reality. The Islamic Republic committed a terrible sin when the Shah of Iran was overthrown. The Shah and Israel were the two feet, the two powers through which the West fundamentally sought to control the entire region of West Asia. And when the Shah fell, this was a huge defeat for Western domination of the region and for Western diplomacy as well. So ever since then, of course, they have tried to punish a power which does not submit. They've tried to undo the defeat that they suffered in 1979 and afterwards. So the determination of the Islamic Republic to survive, the use of the projection of the development of powerful defensive militaries going hand in hand with an attempt to build links with regional states is absolutely critical. And never more so than now, when the old certainties of a unipolar world after the defeat of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and unchallenged US domination throughout most of the world, the US didn't need diplomacy. They were able to coerce not just Britain, but many, many other countries into a very subservient alliance. But now with American power diminishing, and America, even in the last few days or weeks, unable to enforce its will, for example, on China, tariffs, this has been observed around the world, and people, and the need for America to actually use diplomacy has never been greater, but at the moment, their ability to do so has never been less. So I think it's a great time to be an Iranian or a Chinese or a Russian diplomat, because doors that were previously closed, I think Trump has blown wide open with the way in which he uses the threat of military force against allies and against opponents as well.
Thank you, Mick, for your opening thoughts there. And Sayed, thanks for your patience. Welcome to the conversation here. And your opening take, if you could, please, on Iran's strategic patience over the years when it comes to adversaries, many attempts to bait the country, deploying heavily on diplomacy, both to survive and to thrive as a nation, and how today it manifests in these indirect talks when engaging with the U.S. on the country's nuclear program and sanctions removal.
I think Iran has been always leaning towards diplomacy and creating partnerships and reaching out to even its enemies. This is part of the complaint within some of the Iranian society that perhaps Iran has been too deferential, and given these malevolent powers that literally want Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, folded and destroyed, with the evidence of PSYOP upon PSYOP that they carry out and the wars that they triggered Saddam Hussein, starting with Saddam Hussein and then the Takfiris and ISIS. So, you know, there's also that counter argument to say that Iran's noble efforts to try and maintain peace, bring together the people through diplomacy to try and do economic deals, has actually been, in some ways, naive, some would say. But the reality is that in realpolitik, you have to be realistic. And at the end of the day, the Islamic Republic of Iran was literally a nation which was simply feeding off the Anglo-Zionist Empire. It could do barely anything for itself. You know, the petroleum plants, the business, the corporations, everything was in the hands of the Zionists and the Americans, etc., when the Shah was around. So for it to go from that point of literally having little or no universities, a female population which was uneducated, the general population, rural population, being sort of miserably and woefully poor and trapped. And of course, that whole knowledge economy, which was there of brilliant Iranian young people, has been unleashed by the revolution in 1979, to the point where we now have, of course, you know, hundreds of and hundreds, you know, maybe thousands of universities around the country. There's something like a 98% literacy rate amongst Iranian women alone. You know, there are, you know, advances within nanotechnology, advances within all of the scientific and technological fields that people wouldn't even believe, you know, but in terms of robotics, in terms of chemical engineering, the peaceful nuclear program that they've been developing, in the fields of virtually every area you can mention, you know, even plastic surgery, you know, these kind of areas are all being advanced rapidly. And I think this is what also sticks in the gullet of the Anglo-Zionist Empire. So when the Iranians have been negotiating and trying to do the JCPOA deal, for instance, which went through and then was, you know, turned back upon by the Americans, by Donald Trump, indeed. And it's kind of sometimes a little frustrating to think that, well, Iran is still persisting with what looks like perhaps putting some kind of trust in the Western imperialists. But I think that's the nature of the Iranian mindset. It wants peace. It wants to do things peacefully. But the reason they've had to even resort to the stick, which my colleague referred to, through the IRGC and through their policy of, hybrid regional actions in West Asia, were only because the Americans have surrounded Iran with bases, with proxies, with terrorists, with their own, you know, puppet governments in Saudi Arabia, et cetera, et cetera. So the Iranians were left with literally no choice. Otherwise, what they would have had was what the Americans initiated through Saddam Hussein, which was an invasion of Iran. And you would see Iran attacked militarily. So diplomacy has been their way.
Thank you, Sayed. And Mick, you're on today, and I'm going to put the same basically narrative that I was putting to Sayed to you. It's involved in more diplomacy to try to confront and answer more hostility from the West, namely the U.S. Concerns about its nuclear program in the so-called indirect talks that initially took place in Oman, off to Rome, back to Oman, and we're still trying to guess where next week's fourth round of indirect talks will be. But we saw Iran's foreign minister throughout the last 3 weeks fly to Moscow, go to Beijing, and incorporate Russian and Chinese partners. How do you gauge the ramifications of this evolution to the east, not just by Tehran, but many other capitals over the past couple of decades? And to your earlier point, it seems like it's the U.S. itself, with its coercive measures, rhetoric, and sanctions, and bullying, that it's the one that's igniting and bringing about this new world order, isn't it?
Sure. I wonder what people are talking about in Egyptian homes tonight when Trump demands free passage for U.S. military and commercial shipping through the Suez Canal. I mean, how high-handed can you get? How contemptuous can you get? This is a major source of income for the Egyptian state and economy. And when Trump turns up to demand free passage, of course, for Panama as well, this is so insulting. This doesn't play well. And the man is driving people to an understanding that what he's talking about vis-a-vis Panama, now Egypt, even Denmark, a NATO member, is a big stick, which he's openly threatening to use, but which could be used against anyone. So I think the world is watching Trump. Biden was a bit more clever. I mean, he was just as militaristic. Obama was just as keen on, but even more keen perhaps, on foreign invasions. And I think there's another reason why diplomacy is critical here. I mean, diplomacy is a different dimension of relationships. As long as other states exist, whether they are bitter enemies, trying to be neutral, or allies, diplomacy is essential. It's just a part of the way the world turns, as well as being defensive and being prepared to for a state to defend itself. But when you get the situation now where Trump's popularity inside America is plummeting, even among the people who voted for him, the Republicans, then diplomacy that reaches out to other states and also reaches out to other populations For example, the people of Saudi Arabia, huge numbers of them, will not support their government in its attempt, in its alliance with Israel, to try and neutralize the efforts by the Yemenis to end the Gaza genocide. I think diplomacy that reaches towards other states, but also at the same time reaches towards other populations, in this particular, is always important, but in this particular juncture of instability, of populations beginning to force governments in directions that they didn't go before, I think we are now entering a period when diplomacy is key. And the efforts of the Islamic Republic to consolidate support from friends and allies, to reach out to countries that would rather remain neutral or would even prefer to be in the American camp but are repelled and whose populations are repulsed by the antics in Washington. And also to reach out to enemies to say, you know, there will be a cost if you continue to be as hostile as you have been to the Islamic Republic. That type of diplomacy is unavoidable. It's essential. But I think in the present period, there's a greater premium on that because of Trump replacing Biden with this very similar militarism and aggression and imperialism, but a different rhetoric, which is foolish and stupid in the sense that it alienates governments and elements in the past which might have preferred to remain silent or gravitate towards America, but are now absolutely revolted by what's happening.
Very well stated and put there, Mick. Thank you. And Sayed, just in the past 3 weeks that Iran's been engaged in these indirect talks with the U.S. on sanctions removal and nuclear concerns, Tehran has received IAEA head Rafael Grossi, seven-plus year tensions continue to thaw with the Saudis, as Saudi authorities have made a Tehran visit throughout this time. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has extended to the E3 an olive branch, albeit through a social media post, a post on X, but nevertheless, he said, okay, we are engaging the U.S. Indirectly, but if you have any concerns that you would like allied to the U.K., to France, and to Germany, that Iran's diplomatic channels are open. Also, the third Iran-Africa Economic Cooperation Summit is taking place in Tehran, and that constitutes over 700 traders from the 54 nation, for the country continent there of Africa. Basically, diplomacy everywhere, Sayed. How many countries have had this kind of Western target, especially by the U.S., on their back for this long, on the level it has been, and continue to stay diplomatically, economically, and politically relevant?
Well, not very many. Cuba comes to mind, I guess. Venezuela to some extent. And even the Russians are, of course, under huge sanctions. But this length of period is pretty unique. It's almost, I think, along with perhaps Cuba, probably the longest time that an American government has squeezed with 360-degree full-spectrum sanctions a nation. And perhaps I think the Iranian sanctions have been more comprehensive than anything even Cuba faced, to be fair. And they had the backup, I guess, of Russia as well, in a way, back in those days. Now, the thing is, Iran has progressed rapidly in terms of its deals. It's no longer in that mindset where everything is looking west. This, of course, President Raisi started this in a really positive way, and sadly his demise left people wondering whether that was going to continue. But of course, Iranian policy isn't just, I think, from government to government. There are underlying policies which are thought out by the smart thinkers that they clearly have in the background within the establishment. And those figures have made it clear that they are going to do deals with Russia. Indeed, in January, we saw the comprehensive Iranian-Russian deal come through. And that is one typical example of the way the Iranians are consolidating themselves in the world outside of the Anglo-Zionist sphere, if you like. And that if you look at that treaty in detail, it does indeed cover everything from culture through to technology sharing, through to sort of scientific collaboration, even military collaboration and defense partnerships. And if the Russians adhere to that, and if the Iranians adhere to it, that's two massive powers, which the Americans basically have a problem with, who are united. Now, to what extent that would mean they would collaborate, for instance, does it mean that if America attacks Iran militarily, does that mean the Russians will support Iran fully? One would hope so. That's hopefully what these agreements are all about. On the other hand, you've got the other real emerging force, tour de force in the world, which is China. And as I think really nobody in the East really can ignore China, not even in the West now. Clearly, Americans are going to find that out very soon. But the in the East, the Eurasian Axis, the Shanghai Corporation, the Belt and Road Initiative, Iran is part of all of this. They are an integral part of that movement. So those are two major allies they've consolidated with. Even with India, another major force in that region, they have trade deals. They do oil deals, and it's a major trading partner, you know, like it or not. So Iran has nurtured some very powerful connections. I think that's why the resistance economy has survived, because, you know, really the Americans literally will punish any nation that is small enough to do so with sanctions and all sorts of other threats if they work with Iran. So Iran has done splendidly to be able to survive as it is in the resistance economy sense.
And I want to put this in a slightly different dimension to you, if I could, Mr. McNapier. This third Iran-Africa Economic Cooperation Conference I just mentioned, it's taking place here in the Iranian capital from April 27th to May 1st. There are over 700 traders from 38 African countries, along with over 50 senior officials, including ministers and Chamber of Commerce leaders from 29 African nations. They're all present, okay? But this isn't just a question of Iran trying to weather and endure the U.S. So-called maximum pressure sanctions campaign against the Islamic Republic. What I wanted to get your take on is the actual countries here. The bigger concern that I think should for Washington should be that even superpowers today aren't really biting when it comes to not dealing with the Islamic Republic. You got all these countries in Africa, they're not biting, they're not respecting U.S. threats of sanctions against them and retribution if they engage with the Islamic Republic. That has to be very concerning for Washington, that it's a let's isolate Iran campaign is pretty much falling flat on its face.
Well, you would think it would be very concerning for Washington, but they're behaving in a very irrational manner at one level. I mean, because Trump courted for his elections a white supremacist base, electoral base, in a way that Biden didn't quite, he's now following that through into foreign policy. So we see, I mean, when the Iranian Republic is doing diplomacy with African countries, really, it's theirs to lose. The whole history of the West in South Africa, let's leave that for a moment in Africa. But today, Musk is giving Nazi salutes. Musk is financing extreme right Islamophobic parties in Britain and Germany. And Trump is beating the drum for the poor, supposedly discriminated against white farmers of South Africa, at the same time as he's jailing and expelling brown-skinned people and black people from America by the plane load, even two-year-olds. So the whole effect of this current American government is to drive African countries to look elsewhere. And if the Iranian Republic has its arms open and wishes to engage in a positive economic, cultural, multispectral way, then I think there's never been a better moment to prise countries away from the NATO North American sphere. So I think, having weathered this brutal storm of sanctions since 1979, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. Mm. That now feeds into the self-inflicted wounds of the American regime in relation to Africa. So I think it's looking good for Iranian diplomacy right across Africa.
Gentlemen, thank you. Both time has gotten the better of us. McNapier, their activist and commentator, joining us from Glasgow, and Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. And viewers, this brings us to the conclusion of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to a new episode of Old Lady's Favorite Muslim Lady. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be at your service in the coziest place for women. Well, and here with me, I have Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, really, for coming here. Well, it's always a pleasure to be here with you, an honor, a great honor to be with all these great ladies that are listening to us. Well, in Muslim Lady, we usually talk about all the women of the planet Earth, all the sisters, all the mothers, all the composers of the most beautiful whispers of kindness and of joy. Therefore, today also we're here to talk about one of the, I guess, very interesting things for all the women all around the world. Well, I know that there are many women out there who do not love gold and all that shines. It's not something that all women would love. But then, culturally speaking, if we look back in history, we see that it has got a symbolic meaning in itself. Gold, usually, and if you look back in literature, in mythology, you would see that gold is always linked with empowerment, with beauty, and also to some points, purifying effects. Like in many stories, you see that they use gold with another stuff to add purification to a soul, to a body, for healing powers that it has got. Like it is believed. It was believed in ancient cultures, Indian, Chinese, Egyptian. They all believed that there is a healing power in gold, and they used it in the remedies they created for the Sikh people. So if we consider all of these staffs, we come to this point that is it only an ornament or no? It's more than that.
Yes, gold is more than an ornament, basically. It holds both a spiritual and also the worldly significance. It is viewed, as you rightly mentioned, a symbol. And symbol of what? It's a symbol of beauty, it's a symbol of wealth, and it's also a symbol of divine blessings. As we say, the Quran and Ahadith mention gold as a part of bounties of paradise, like we have in Surah Hajj. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks of the adornments of paradise. He says that the bracelets of gold and pearls and their garments will be of silk. Well, talking about the rewards of those who believe. So it's also mentioned in Ahadith, for example, you know, when Prophet, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, when he was on Mi'raj, he saw angels constructing the palaces with the bricks of gold and silver. Mm-hmm. And then they were stopping. Then they were doing it again, and then they were stopping. So he asked the question, and it was said, when a believer is on the planet Earth, engaged in zikr, they start constructing a palace for him made of the bricks of gold and silver. And when he stops, they also stop constructing.
Yeah, so it depends on the dhikrs they are mentioning.
Yes, so Quran and Ahadith have also mentioned it. And apart from that, it also represents responsibility and purity. Mm-hmm. Surah Tawbah, for example, says, "And those who hoard gold and silver and spend it not in the way of Allah, give them tidings of a painful punishment." We can elaborate this later on, but it's like if you, there's a responsibility. Even if you have that, you have to look for the ways of like charity and other things. So God has always held a special place in the hearts of women across the cultures. Yeah. And Islam acknowledges a woman's...
If they can't afford it today. Yeah.
Islam acknowledges a woman's natural love for beauty and elegance. If you can afford it, I would like to add a hadith of Imam Sadiq al-Islam here. He says that the... jewelry, an ornament of a woman is her modesty.
Exactly. So, yeah. Yeah. I wanted to mention that later on. That yes, flowers, beautiful stuff, golds, things that shine usually are connected to women. And usually, when you want to make them happy, you offer them a bundle of flowers, perhaps a bouquet of flowers or some golds. But then, these things should not make you forget about the inner gold.
Yeah.
Sometimes things would shine from the outside, but they did not have that radiancy from the inside. So this is very important to keep in mind. But since women are always accused of being in love with gold, now I guess we go for a short break and then we'll come back to see what's more.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. Well, this is Muslim Lady. I'm Asma. Sister Zainab is here with me, and we're talking about gold and how they're connected to women. Well, we already explained that symbolically speaking, culturally speaking, specifically in Eastern culture, there has been many perceptions actually linked to gold and women. They've got a lot of meanings. We gave an explanation on that. Well, just like hints and clues about that. But then we came to this point that gold is not just an ornament. It's more than that. Sometimes, if you look back in history, in movies, in books, you see that gold works as an investment. Yes, true that even in many cases, it becomes a way of preserving the heritage of a family. Like there's a small ring coming down from different ancestors to the new generations. So it keeps history to itself. It's got a lot of symbolical meaning to itself. And it's not just this material that they wear it on. It has much more important meaning than that. So, let's elaborate more on how gold becomes a matter of not just being an ornament for a woman.
So, yeah, gold is not seen only as a form of adornment, but also a secure asset for women, as you mentioned already, because it offers them the financial independence. Yeah. It offers them dignity. The act of receiving gold as a gift releases dopamine, the love hormone, which explains it why it brings love with it. So, yeah. And also Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, he permitted women to wear gold, encouraging them to embrace beauty within the boundaries of modesty. So gold jewelry, often passed down through generations, becomes a symbol of love and security. It is more than a decoration. It is a woman's rightful possession, her wealth. And I would say more importantly, it's often her shield in the times of hardship. I remember like when my sisters were getting married and I was telling them, why you are amassing gold jewelry for your marriage? It's okay to like just to go ahead with one ring and that's it. And they were like, we want a shield in the times of hardship.
Yeah, so, yeah. I told you, they take that as an investment.
Yeah. However, like on its use, Islam sets clear boundaries. Like Muslim men are prohibited from wearing gold jewelry, while women are permitted to adorn themselves with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here comes a clear line. of its use. So since men are more prone to, you know, pride in outward displays, I would say, the prohibition acts as a safeguard here.
Yeah, and the important thing is that actually why it's not good for women. It's good for women and it's not good for a man.
Yes. Whenever Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whenever he gives us laws, the Islamic commandments, there's always a wisdom behind every commandment, right?
And logical reason behind that.
Yes, we sometimes may be able to deduce some of the reasons and sometimes we are not able to deduce. But since we are not able to deduce that logical background behind that, that does not mean that it did not hold any wisdom for
exactly.
me. Even when we deduce those logical reasons behind that commandment, still, because of the limitations of our brains, we are not able to comprehend it entire mm-hmm. wisdom behind it. However,
exactly.
that is the limited comprehension that we have. It is suggested that, for example, women's adornment, it's private. It's for home and for mahram, basically. So while men's adornment is normally public, and if men wore gold, it could lead to vanity and competition in the society, distraction from his higher goals, like, I don't know, for knowledge, for worship, for the higher struggles in life. Because men's jewelry often correlates with status obsessions, while when woman adorns herself with gold, it is more tied to self-expression and marital harmony.
Well, by the way, I have to mention some point in here, just for the record. Women do not identify themselves with how much gold they have.
Exactly.
The inner
important.
Gold is much more important. Sometimes you do not afford much of gold or whatever that shines. But the thing is that you're wealthy enough from the inside. So your personality, your personal worth is much more important than what you wear on.
Yeah.
This is very important. Because usually, you know, there is this wrong notion about women that many people hold in this world. They do believe that women are only interested in this superficial stuff, and this is all that they are going to be identified with.
While they're interested in security.
Yeah. Well, the truth is something very different. All the mothers in the time of hardships, even if they have goals, they come and offer it to the family. With being so selfless and with too much of modesty, with too
as
much of
love. As you said, shield in the times of hardship.
Yeah. So gold is not what defines a woman. Actually, a woman with her personality, with her worth, is going to give worth to that metal. You know, it's a kind of metal. So
yeah.
It does not in itself has any sort of worth. There are some empowering effects that gold holds when a woman wears it on, and it could actually improve and boost the immune system, if I'm not mistaken. This is what they have taught us from the childhood, like
right.
the, you know, the homemade remedies usually tell you that gold is good for your immune system.
Yeah. Especially for women.
Especially.
Yeah.
And it has the opposite effect for men.
Right. Right. As we said, that due to the biological and different factors, mm-hmm. it affects both the genders differently. For example, men naturally have a warmer temperament. So gold being a warmer metal, it could overheat their system and that could lead to aggression.
Yeah.
And that could also lead to imbalance in their system. So on the contrary, women tend to have a cooler disposition.
And just for the record, sorry to interrupt you, just for another reason that everybody says it right now, everybody talks about it. It's about the blood cells.
Yeah.
The red blood cells are going to be reduced if a man wears gold.
Yes. It has a lot of like...
A lot of consequences. Yes. So let's move to women.
Yeah. So women, like, since they have a cooler disposition, so gold's warmth balances her physiology. It improves circulation in her.
Mm-hmm.
Completely the contrary because of the biological differences. And also it improves her emotional stability. So adornment boosts self-esteem and confidence in women. Psychologists like Carl Rogers, they have highlighted the importance of self-expression in mental well-being and jewelry. Like gold serves as an extension to that. So Islam encourages men to spend wealth in charity, family, and community, not self-adornment. And also it encourages women to spend. Gold and silk are linked to delicate aesthetics, mm-hmm. apart from this, so which Islam reserves for women. So Prophet, peace be upon him and his purified family, he cursed men who imitate women. So this restriction is not about deprivation, like depriving some mm-hmm. gender of something, but it's about purification, guarding men towards spiritual strength over materialism, guiding them towards humility over mm-hmm. arrogance, biological balance in line with their nature. While gold is permissible, I would like to add this last point, and even beneficial for women, it should be noted that it should not become a means of arrogance or materialism,
exactly.
as we mentioned earlier, or Rumi puts it very beautifully, the same gold that adorns can also enslave, so wear it as a blessing, not a chain.
Exactly. So as the final point, since we talked about the wisdom of Islam, in Islam, Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam always encourage the men, actually, to gift women, to give them stuff that are going to work as investment for them, as a shield, as you just said, for women in the hard times. That's why they tell them to buy gold for women. So it's a gift. At the same time, it's going to be an investment. It's going to be something that would work for them in the hard times. So thank you, Sister Zainab. I hope this episode works as a trigger for us to think more about our daily life. So this was all for today. I hope you have just enjoyed it. Until another session of Muslim Lady. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
In fact, the future Israel has created for itself has never seemed less certain. Over 80 years, it has completely failed to integrate into the West Asia region. Instead, it chose to force itself upon the region. The consequences have been catastrophic. The Israeli regime remains what it was at the start, a violent Western outpost in West Asia region. Without Western arms, money, and political protection, it cannot survive. It has nothing else to fall back on, and these gifts will not continue indefinitely. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the first part. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Gaza has been turned into a death zone by the Zionist regime, with deliberate mass-scale violence and complicity from its civilian population, while the international community remains largely indifferent. War crimes and crimes against humanity are being committed in Gaza on a scale we have never seen before, not in the lifetime of almost all of us. They have been committed every day for more than 18 months now. No one escapes. Not the young and not the old. Not the disabled and not in the patients in the hospital. There is no sanctuary, no safe place. The Palestinians are burned to death in tents. They are terrorized into flight from one part of Gaza to another. They are lured into safe places and then bombed. They are being starved to death, deliberately denied food, water and electricity, thereby condemning hospital patients to death. The genocide is comprehensive, deliberate, mass murder planned in advance and carried out with great attention to detail. There is no money, no compassion, no common humanity. The whole of Gaza has been turned into a death zone. The cruelty is hard to comprehend. This is not just the government or the military command or the soldiers sniping at children and blowing up hospitals, but the Zionist regime's civilian Jewish population. Israelis march against child killer Netanyahu, but not once have they marched against the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza. Not once have they marched against the killing of 19,000 to 20,000 Palestinian children by their army and air force. The polls since late 2023 have been consistent in recording the complicity of the majority of Israeli Jewish population. A poll carried out by Tel Aviv University Research Institute in late 2023, when hospitals had already been bombed and thousands of civilians killed, revealed that only 2% of those polled thought too much firepower was being used in Gaza. Nearly 58% thought it was too little. A poll carried out by the Viterbi Family Center for Public Opinion and Policy Research at the Israel Democracy Institute, also in late 2023, revealed that more than 80% of those polled believed the suffering of the civilian population should be taken into account only to a very small extent, or a fairly small extent. A Pew Research Center poll released on May 30, 2024, found that 19% of those polled thought the military had gone too far, 39% that it had got it about right, and 34% not far enough. So, 73% about right or not far enough at a time more than 35,000 Palestinian civilians had been killed. A high proportion of them, about 70%, women and children. An Israeli Democracy Institute poll of October 2024 found 53% favored ending the way, not because of the mass killing of Palestinians, but because of damage to the hostages. 62% thought bringing back the hostages should be the primary goal of the war. Only 3% thought the war should be ended because of the cost in human life and the desire for peace and quiet. For whom? Not specified. 86% of Jews graded the role of the military as excellent, and 61% opposed the investigation of soldiers accused of abusing Palestinian prisoners. At the same time, 48% were pessimistic about the future of the regime. Since October 2023, tens of thousands of Israelis have voted with their feet by leaving Palestine, the reason for which is not to be misinterpreted in any way as sympathy for the Palestinians. Not one poll has been based on attitudes towards the slow extermination of the Palestinian population. Israelis are not asked whether they think it is right, even in the war, for families to be burnt alive in their tents or paramedics and aid workers murdered on the road. Not one question is asked about the mass killing of the totally innocent children. This world historic crime does not even register in the daily Israeli news cycle.
Del corazón de Asia Occidental, la hora de Irán te sumerge en el mundo persa. Conocerás su cultura y posición en el mundo.
Hola, queridos oyentes. Bienvenidos a una nueva emisión de La Hora de Irán.